Hey y'all, welcome to episode 9 of the Plaid Pilot Podcast. I'm your host, Todd Weld. 104 years ago this week, Eddie Rickenbacker took to the skies on a solo patrol mission over France behind enemy lines and shot down two enemy aircraft, earning himself the Medal of Honor. Next week would have marked his 132nd birthday, so Greg Primus is joining me again in a two-part episode to tell his story. I guess we're recording. I didn't see it go to zero.
Oh, well, yeah.
Red light. All right, we're recording. Yeah, we got a red light. So how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. It's been a little bit. It's been a couple weeks.
Yeah, it has. Episode 4. People should remember you from Wiley Post episode.
Absolutely. I'm back.
So I guess for anybody who didn't listen to episode 4, although they certainly should go back and listen to episode 4.
100%.
You want to introduce yourself and talk a little bit about what you do and that kind of thing?
Yep. So I'm Gregory Primus. I'm in the Air Force. I work on the F-22 as avionics. So I'm like the geek squad of the aircraft. The jet comes down, has a radar problem. I troubleshoot and change any parts or modules that have to do with the radar. Right now I'm stationed at Nellis Air Force Base. I was stationed at Edwards working on the F-22. So yeah, that's just about it. It's a quick introduction, but yeah, definitely go watch the other one for a longer introduction.
There you go.
There we go.
And you're getting ready to go TDY, right? I don't know if that's something you can talk about about.
I'm about to go to Edwards TDY for F-22 related stuff. So yeah, just some new software and things coming down the line for the F-22. Always testing. These new aircraft are always need to have test on it.
Yeah, of course. Can't have things failing.
I know, right? Exactly.
So obviously today we're here to talk about Eddie Rickenbacker, talk a little bit about his life. But before we get started with that, I want to take a minute to recognize the Plaid Pilot Podcast Aviatrix of the Week. So Christy recently soloed, and she flies out of Womoma Air Park in Florida. I think that's how you say it, Womoma. I asked her about coming on to talk about her experience. Unfortunately, right now she's right in the path of Hurricane Ian, which is getting ready to make landfall. It may actually have arrived by the time this goes live. So congratulations on your solo. I know it's a huge milestone, maybe the biggest one in a pilot's career. But definitely stay safe out there. Hopefully the storm passes over with minimal damage or no damage, ideally. I know stuff out there, it's built to withstand that kind of stuff. But we're definitely thinking about y'all. So if you guys want to see what Christy's up to, you can check her stuff out on Instagram at Mermaid Christy, and I'll throw that in the show notes as usual, so you can go find that after the episode. Now, if you or someone you know would be interested in being recognized as the Plaid Pilot Podcast Aviator or Aviatrix of the Week, please get in touch with me. You can either email me at todd@theplaidpilot.com or hit me up on Instagram at @theplaidpilot. Now, on to the story. All right, well, today we are actually here to talk about Eddie Rickenbacker, who I had, I guess we heard about him in the Air Force. Was there like a DFAC named after him? It seems like there was.
Yes, there was like a whole bunch of things. There was like awards named after him, DFAC named after him. Civil Air Patrol, they have a milestone. I think if you get to Tech Sergeant, I think it's called the Eddie Rickenbacker Award or something. So there's a whole bunch of awards related to him in the Air Force and Civil Air Patrol.
Yeah, he was, I don't remember learning. I know like Etchberger, we learned a lot about him in basic training and just Air Force history stuff. I don't remember specifically learning about Rickenbacker too much. I've read a couple books where he's been featured in it. I believe it's called, one of them's called The Aviators. It focuses on him, Charles Lindbergh, and I want to say Jimmy Doolittle. And I think that was kind of my first actual introduction, other than just hearing the name in the Air Force. Were you familiar with him at all before?
Not too much. Just remember hearing his name and the DFAC and never really actually looked him up in a sense. Because I think there was a couple videos, like motivational videos that they would show us in like on the flight line or during a commander's call or something. And he would kind of give like a general, like a maybe 2-minute video of him. So I didn't really go into detail, but... But yeah, kind of familiar, but familiar with the name, but not his background.
Right,
complete
right.
Background.
Yeah, exactly. And he had an interesting background, as much automotive as aviation.
Yes, absolutely.
So he was actually born Edward Rickenbacker, with a C-H-E-R at the end instead of a K, was not given a middle name at birth. And that was on October 8th of 1890. So that's been a lot of years now.
It's been a few, more than 10.
Definitely more than 10.
More than 10.
In Columbus, Ohio. So his parents were actually from Switzerland. They were Swiss immigrants. And they met, got together in Columbus, Ohio, and had Edward and some other kids as well. They actually, they built their own home in, I think it was 1893?
Yes, 1893.
So they had a lot. I don't know if they owned two lots or if it was just one big lot that they subdivided. But Edward's mother, Elizabeth, she wanted to break the lot in half, sell half of it to fund the building of the house. And her husband was like, no, we want to keep the land. And she won that argument, I guess.
Oh, so, yeah, classic.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So happy wife, happy life. They ended up selling that other lot, building this house, 1893. So, of course, 1893, you're not going to have a lot of the standard amenities that we do today. Some of that indoor plumbing and that kind of thing.
Yep, electricity, running water, yeah.
Right, yeah. It's just kind of a building to hang out in.
Yeah.
But it was a nice neighborhood that they lived in with a lot of other Swiss immigrants. They never had a lot of extra money, though. Eddie's father did a lot of, his name was William, did a lot of construction jobs. I believe he actually owned his own construction company at one point. And so up until 1904, Eddie, he did okay at school. He wasn't kind of the star student, but he wasn't bad either. He was a smart individual. But in 1904, that all changed. I think he was in the seventh grade. He'd have been about 13, 14 years old. And his father, he had a really bad temper on him. And on one of these job sites, there was another laborer. I don't think he worked for William. I think he was just working on a job site.
Okay.
Yeah, in the area.
Yeah.
His name was William Gaines. And he came up to the job site and started asking for food. So don't know if he was transient or what the situation was there, why he didn't have food, why he needed food from Eddie's dad. Eddie's dad didn't like it, whatever, whether it was the way he was approached or if he just had flipped a switch kind of thing. I don't know.
Something.
But so they started fighting. Kind of sounds like Rickenbacker started the fight with Gaines over him asking for the food. And then unfortunately Gaines decided to finish it. He actually grabbed a, what do they call it? Like a concrete leveler, one of those long metal pieces that you run over the wet cement to level everything out, and got him across the head with it pretty good, fractured his skull. And he actually went into a coma. Gaines ran away because he realized he'd taken it too far for sure.
Yeah.
And, ended up getting arrested. Unfortunately, 5 or 6 weeks later, William Rickenbacker passed away. I don't know that he ever regained consciousness from that. And then William Gaines was then charged with manslaughter and sentenced 10 years in prison for that.
Yeah, it's highly unfortunate. It happens at the job site. Yeah, getting schwacked in the head with a concrete. It's not always good. But yeah, he went to a coma 6 weeks and he later died. That really had an effect on Edward Rickenbacker, on Eddie.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, at that point, he basically became, you know, whether that was put on him by his family or whether he took it upon himself, you know, he kind of became the man of the house at that point. So he's this 13, 14 year old kid. And now he's got to drop out of school, or he feels like he has to drop out of school. And so he's starting to take odd jobs, trying to get, you know, trying to make ends meet for his parents. So his mother, I believe she had a job as well. But when you start out from a place of not a lot of money and then you cut that in half, doesn't do well.
Does not can't sustain, not sustainable.
Right. Drops out of school, starts taking odd jobs, works at glass factories, a lot of industrial type stuff, metalworks and things like that. I guess he also worked in a beer factory, bowling alley, cemetery, monument yard.
It's all kind of things.
Right. Just whatever he could pick up, I'm sure.
Yep.
Pennsylvania Railroad as an apprentice. Yeah, so at one point he got on with the Columbus, Ohio Railway Company. I think that job kind of ended up being his,
he kind of settled into that, was never particularly happy with it. He enjoyed, I think, the way that the machines worked and that kind of thing, but he wanted something a little more exciting, you know, speed and and that kind of thing.
Yep, right up his alley for speed.
Right. And so he joins this company, and then they're pulling some metal in a wagon. They have these wagons that haul some of the metal around, and the wheel actually falls off one of these wagons, and wagon full of metal ends up falling on to his leg and crushing it. So he ended up in recovery. Like, he couldn't work during that time because he's obviously fairly injured. It seems to be, I guess, a theme of Wile E. Post.
Injuries and industrial areas. So I guess that's...
So he ended up in recovery, having to just sit things out for a little bit. I assume probably not on a paid status at the time, didn't have a choice because he didn't have a working leg. And while he is sitting around doing nothing because he's trying to get better, he realizes that he doesn't want to keep doing what he's doing. He wants to really get involved in the automotive industry. He actually met somebody one day, I guess, running around town or whatever. There was a Ford salesman, and he notices while he's walking around, there's a crowd of people gathered, goes up to the crowd of people, and they're all around this new machine. Eddie was able to convince him to give him a ride. And so he gave him a ride around town, and he loved it. That was his first experience with automobiles. Kind of gave him that automotive bug, I guess.
Yep, the spark. Like with anything, you fly once, you can't stop.
Right, yeah. And it's interesting to me how often, especially back then, but how often cars and airplanes went together. Like, so he actually went to go work with Lee Frayer at the Columbus Buggy Company. He had to take some engineering courses, correspondence courses. So after getting some of those engineering courses, he ended up going to work for Lee Frayer. Lee Frayer got involved with the Long Island Vanderbilt Cup in 1906, decided he was going to race. And so he wanted to bring Rickenbacker on as his mechanic, or I guess back then they called it the mechanician. And it was basically your mechanic that rode along on the race with you and kind of troubleshot systems and that kind of thing. Kind of like a crew chief, I guess, for modern day, except obviously crew chiefs hang out in the pit and don't get to ride around the track. But they were taking this new air-cooled model of race car, which was, I guess, a kind of a novel concept at the time. Still kind of a novel concept. I guess VWs use it, but not a lot of other vehicles still do the air-cooled thing. But airplanes do. So yes. Go figure. I guess airplanes don't idle as much as cars.
Yeah, they're going, you know, at least 100 miles an hour.
Right. So that was his first taste of actual racing. And so, you know, he enjoyed it, just taking that test drive around town. But and he got on the racetrack, and it was something really exciting. So discovers that love of racing. As a result of that race, Frayer was actually hired by the Firestone Columbus Company to design and got to build the Firestone Columbus automobile. Firestone obviously makes tires.
Yes, they made it this far.
They just had to shift gears, I guess, a little bit from whole cars down to tires, and it worked out for him. And so he picked Eddie to be the chief engineer and tester, brought him along with that on that endeavor. So Eddie's getting to travel around, does demos, demonstrations and sales and stuff, gets to go around Texas a little bit. They bring him back to Ohio. And one day he's actually sitting in his office, and I guess he's really close to the train tracks, sticks his head out the window of his office one day, or could be the door, I don't know, sticks his head out of the office one day as a train is coming by, and an ember gets into his eye, burns, I think it was his right eye, and he ends up losing 30% of his peripheral vision.
Dang.
Which, yeah, not ideal for race car drivers or pilots.
Yes.
So in he's... hurts his eye, so he's still, I guess, just doing the sales and stuff like that. In 1911, this brand new race comes out. It's a 500-miler in a little town called Indianapolis, and they liked it so much that they still do it today, call it the Indianapolis 500. And for the very first race, Frayer's going to be participating in it, and he says, hey, Eddie, why don't you come out and help me out on this one? So he's going to be his co-driver. I guess they race in teams with 500 miles. They don't usually have one driver do the whole thing.
Yeah, it's a lot of laps.
So at this very first Indianapolis 500, they had 40 racers. they were competing for a pot of over $27,000. I think it was like $27,550 or something like that, which was an exorbitant amount of money back then. And there was 80,000 people in the audience to watch this. So car racing was a really big deal back then.
Yeah, 80,000 is a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot of people in one place.
Right. And I don't know what the population of Indianapolis was at the time, but I mean, I think there's a lot of stadiums that NFL stadiums that hold 60 or 70,000 today. Yes. Yeah. So just huge crowd. And Eddie actually got to drive the first 400 miles of that race. He drove the lion's share of it. And then Freyer came in for the last 100 miles, drove those, and they actually ended up finishing 11th out of the 40. So almost top 25%. It's not bad.
Not bad.
Got him a little bit of notoriety. Eddie was actually barred by AAA. I don't think we talked about it in our episode. There was an episode we talked about AAA was actually, they've been around for over 100 years, like 120 years or something like that.
Yep. Been around for a while.
Yeah. And apparently they had a lot of pull on these auto races. And in October of 1912, they barred Eddie Rickenbacker from taking or competing in any of these races because I don't know what he was doing, but he was doing something that they considered unsafe.
Yep, safety regulations.
He wasn't the strictest adherent of those. And so they actually barred him for an entire year from being able to compete in any of these races. So he's not being able to do that. So he actually signs on with a traveling group that they just kind of go around, and there's not so much, I guess they're not really being sanctioned by AAA or anything like that. It's just kind of, we're outside almost of like a small, yeah, there's a small demo group. So he didn't need their blessing for that. And so traveling around with that group, he was actually able to get on with the Duesenberg brothers, who actually came over from Europe. And he was working like 16-hour days, getting paid $3 a day, helping them out with their projects. And Duesenberg, I think, is still around, isn't it?
It does sound familiar. I think that was a...
It's been in a song. It may not be...
Yeah, it might not be a... Yeah, it was American Racing and Luxury Automobile.
Okay.
Seized in 1937.
Oh, wow. So they must have been well-known to make it into songs.
yeah.
That long after the fact. So he's working his way up slowly. His job with the Duesenberg brothers actually got him a deal with Prestolite Batteries. So they have seen him doing his racing thing with the before he got banned by AAA, and then working with this traveling group of racers, and Prestolite Batteries came in and said, "We'll give you your own team. You can manage your own team. We'll give you a couple drivers, give you a few mechanics and stuff like that." So that's what they did. And he was one of the first people at that time to actually drill his pit team, pit crew. So before that, it was kind of just like, all right, you guys help me change tires and stuff. And he was like, no, everybody's got a job. This is how you're going to do it. And we're going to drill it until it's muscle memory. And that really gave him an advantage on the racetrack because his pit stops were a lot shorter.
Oh yeah.
And now obviously you see him and those guys are just insane.
Yep. Three and a half or less to change all four tires.
Right. Yeah. It's just crazy. So with this, AAA finally is like, all right, you can come back in, start racing again, starts touring. And he actually meets two aviators during this around the country tour that would go on to get him into aviation. Met Glenn Martin in California, who gave him his first plane ride. Apparently he was a little bit wary about going up in the air. Wasn't a huge fan of heights.
Oh,
and yeah, right. And so when he met him, Glenn Martin, who would go on to form Glenn L. Martin Company, and eventually through mergers and all that fun stuff would become Lockheed Martin. But this is obviously way before yes. that merger took place, but same guy. So he gave him his first ride, experienced the air, and that's where he really caught the flying bug. And then on that same trip, he actually met Major Townsend F. Dodd, and he found him in I don't know if it was a cornfield, it was some sort of farmer's field with a broke-down airplane. And so he goes up to him, and he's instantly, because he's very familiar with engines and all that kind of stuff, and he's pretty quickly able to say, okay, this is a magneto issue, fixes it for him on the spot, gets him on his way. And that interaction, though it was relatively small, would really change his whole career later on in life.
Oh, yeah.
So World War One starts in Europe. He gets sent over to Europe to tour some of the factories. And, you know, the racing has kind of slowed down in Europe because there's war. And so he's basically been told, you know, see if you can get any schematics or, you know, up and coming designs or whatever that they're not using. Just learn whatever you can, processes for manufacturing, that kind of thing. Bring it back here and see what you can do with it. So he lands in England, immediately is suspected of being a German spy. So he's apprehended at the airport. And the primary reason for this is that at one point, one of the newspapers during his racing career had given him the name Baron von Rickenbacker.
Oh, okay.
For some
reason.
I guess he just thought that it sounded cool. And he's like, oh, how about instead of Edward Rickenbacker, it can be Baron von Rickenbacker. And that was, you know, just one reporter or whatever, but it was enough that, and with the sentiment that was going on at the time, that when he landed in England, they're like, we need to talk to you.
Yeah.
So they, you know, apprehended him, questioned him, eventually decided that, okay, maybe you're not a German spy. They weren't entirely convinced, but they allowed him to continue.
Yes.
So after that whole experience, he comes back to the U.S. and he talked to some of the pilots and stuff over there, and he realized how similar a pilot's mind works with, you know, a race car driver's. You have to have that certain level of system knowledge and mechanical knowledge, and you got to like going fast, and you have to be able to judge speed and distance, and there's a lot of crossover on the two. So he has this idea. He's going to start this all-volunteer racer aero squadron. So get a bunch of racers from the United States, send them overseas, train them to be pilots, and goes to D.C. with this idea. General George E. Squire says no. So he's the head of the Signal Corps at the time. Not a fan of that idea. The Signal Corps, I guess, was kind of, they called it the Millionaires Club, and it's because it was all like your Ivy League colleges and old money from back east and stuff like that that usually got put up as some of these higher-up positions for the Signal Corps. And he didn't want these, what he deemed uneducated, you know, race car drivers becoming pilots and joining this elite club kind of thing.
Yeah.
So he said, no, not going to happen. Don't even ask about it. In 1917, obviously, the U.S. declares war after the Zimmerman Telegraph.
Or Zimmerman Telegram, I guess. The telegraph is a machine actually used to send telegrams. So anyway.
So they decide General Pershing's got to go over, lead the U.S. forces, and he needs a driver.
Yep. So he spent about 5 years racing. Like you said, General Pershing was interested in him being a driver for the Army Air Corps at the time. He accepted that offer. He enlisted on May 25th, 1917. He was ranked as a sergeant first class, and he served as General John J. Pershing's staff driver. So he would drive him around. I think you've seen maybe some videos where there's like a parade or something, or driving around to different places on base. So just a personal chauffeur driving around, which kind of matched. He liked driving cars, so it kind of worked out okay. But he was getting tired of driving, and, you know, being on a military base, you would see at least one or two planes. So he started to get very, very interested in flying, and that's what he really wanted to do. He was able to get his wish, even though he was two years over the limit. So there's always a limit for flying and getting jobs and everything. But he was 2 years over the limit, but there was a waiver that he was able to get to be accepted in the Army Air Service with some help of some friends. And one of those friends was Billy Mitchell, very famous.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, he's incredibly influential.
Yes.
In early aviation, super ahead of his time, so ahead of his time that he would later face court-martial.
Exactly.
Over his
beliefs.
His antics.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
So, yeah, he had a couple of friends in high places. Billy Mitchell was able to get him into the Army Air Services, even though he was 2 years over. So he trained as a fighter pilot in France with the 2nd Aviation Instruction Center. So it's a undergraduate pilot training. They'll teach you how to fly. He completed his course in October of 1917 and commissioned as a first lieutenant and becoming the engineering officer serving under Major Carl A. Spaz. So all these people are coming out. There's a whole bunch of influential people that we're talking about now. And so he wasn't really a pilot per se, but he was the engineering side of being the aviation or the Aviation Institution Center.
So that was kind of his, they wanted him over there, and that was kind of his ace in the hole or whatever. So I'll do that, but yes, you're going to teach me how to fly, right?
Exactly. He was like, okay, I'll do this for you, but I need to fly though. So Major at the time, Spaz, did not want him to become a pilot because they needed him to be a engineer because he was so good at his job. They didn't want him to be a pilot, and they wanted him to stay as an engineer with the squadron. But Eddie really wanted to be a pilot, so he continued putting in requests. And finally, I think it took at least 5 or 6 requests, and he was able to get into the first pursuit group in the 94th Aero Squadron, which the 94th Aero Squadron in present day, it's in Langley, Virginia, and it has F-22s there. So that is the same squadron from back then to now. So that's the squadron up in Langley right now. And they have FF on their code or their tail flash for first fighter. So that was the first fighter group.
I didn't realize that. That's cool.
Yep. So that's
I've seen that. I didn't know where it came from, though.
Yeah. So that's that 94th Aero Squadron. So he was in there. And in April, he flew his first sortie when he finally got deployed. He flew his first sortie, but it was a very foggy day, and it almost ended in disaster. He had a friend up there, went up as a two-ship, and they almost crashed because of the fog. So he was able to land, but his commanding officer like yelled at him and said, like, why did you do that? It's really foggy. Why are you so stupid to fly in foggy weather like that? And back then, their instruments were like very basic. They had a compass, maybe an attitude indicator, and their altimeter. That's probably about it. And looking outside. So 80% of their instruments is looking at the horizon. So flew up.
That was the horizon indicator. Yeah. Looking outside.
Yep, looking outside. If you don't have that, well, you don't have your instruments there. So after his first sortie, a few weeks later, he actually shot down his first aircraft, a German aircraft. He was able to shoot it down without receiving any scratches or bullet holes in his aircraft. So there's not really any story of how he did it, but I'm pretty sure it was like a surprise attack because it's hard to see little tiny aircraft in the sky, and probably came in up high or down low and shot him and then was able to get his first kill. In a few months later in the summer of June 1918, he was able to become an ace, getting being credited five air kills. So already he's an ace within like 6 months of being a pilot.
Which I imagine it back then, a lot of pilots didn't make it to 6 months.
Yes.
The lifespan of the World War One pilot, I think, was measured in weeks rather than
months. Yeah, it was very small. Because it's like it has machine guns on the front of it, and there's no protection for you. It's just all fabric and wood. So if a bullet goes through anywhere, it's going to go through your engine or you, so there's no protection for you at all. And there's bullets flying everywhere in the air, and it's probably one of the gruesomest parts of aviation, aerial war in probably history.
Oh, yeah.
After all of that, he eventually became the commander of the 94th Air Pursuit Squadron, and he kind of gave one of his friends, he was a 94th Aero Pursuit Squadron, and one of his friends said, well, now you're commander of a Aero Pursuit Squadron, and your hat is in the ring. So he gave that phrase, and he said, hat is in the ring. And right now, ever since then, the 94th Fighter Squadron, now, they have their logo, their mascot, is a hat with a ring around it.
And it's
They still use that. It's been the same for almost 100 years, more than 100 years. So they still use the same little logo. And there's a couple of museums you can go to where it has the World War One biplane with the hat and the ring on it. And then it's been like that for all the planes that they have. They stopped putting it on the aircraft, but it's still in the squadron. It's still their logo for their fighter squadron.
That's awesome.
So
real, they kept real heritage there.
Oh, yeah. It's been like that for a while. So for about 3 months, he got sick as the commander. He was sick with an ear infection and fever, grounding him for about 3 months. He was recovering in a hospital in Paris, so he wasn't able to fly for a good while. And he noticed that his squadron had low morale. So to kind of raise that morale a little bit, he flew on a solo mission, which is probably not the best idea. So he flew on a solo mission and shot down 2 enemy planes all by himself. So that may not be safe, but he did it. And as we go on through this podcast, he wasn't the best at making rational decisions. he really wanted to just get it done, and he didn't really put a rationale to his decision that he was making. But his 2 kills brought up everybody up. He landed. Everybody was happy. He shot down 2 kills, and that kind of brought up the morale a little bit. And actually, that action over France earned him the Medal of Honor presented by President Hoover in 1931. So he was able to get one of the few Medal of Honors from the president based off of he did a solo flight and shot down 2 enemy aircraft over France.
That flight where he earned the Medal of Honor for took place on, it's actually, they were recording this, the 25th of September. And so his birthday is next week in history, but that that incident that occurred was this week in history. So that's how we tied in this episode too.
Oh, nice, nice to line that up.
I try and make them so that they're, you know, not necessarily exactly correlate, but something that happened this week in history, and that's why we're going to talk about whatever. So
makes sense, correlation there brings it all around circle.
I wish the calendar had fallen just a little bit different and his birthday would have been the same week as his the Medal of Honor.
Oh yeah, almost
activity. But almost close. I'm like, should I push it to next week? But decided we'll do it for this one. So
yeah. So the Medal of Honor wasn't his only he had a whole bunch of medals. He received the record number of Distinguished Service Cross, totaling 8 for different things that he did throughout his career. Total in World War I, he brought down 26 aircraft during the war, making him the U.S. Ace of aces for the U.S. So with those 26 aircraft, I think on the internet it has like every single aircraft and what day he got it on. But for pretty sure people are asking, is there anybody else who beat his record? There
not
is
in the
one
United
person.
States. There's not.
Well, there
in the U.S.
Yeah, in the U.S.
Oh, not during World War I, though.
Yeah, not during World War I, but after in World War II, it was someone. So in World War I, it wasn't. But in World War II, there was a person that brought it up to 40. He had 40.
One thing I found interesting is for World War I, he was the ace of aces. But his numbers, when you start looking at especially the German pilots, but even the French and the Canadian and the British pilots, their 26 was nothing. We only had, the United States only had one other pilot that even had 20 kills during World War I. And some of these other countries, you know, I think the top ace for the war was von Richthofen, which everybody knows is the Red Baron. And I think he had something over 80. I don't know. I don't think he hit 90.
Oh, yeah.
But had over, had over 80 kills. That's it's so many.
Yeah, it's a lot.
So it's strange that it just worked out that way.
I know. I guess because they're over there already, and they're kind of in their own little element. They don't have
probably,
to travel, probably. So in World War II, it was Richard Bong. He actually got 40 aircraft shot down. So he's the in the United States. So he has the most air-to-air kills in the United States, and it still holds up today.
Okay. Do you know what he flew?
It was a P-38, so he flew that. He got all those kills on a P-38.
Okay. Nice.
And I went on a tangent. I saw that there was went to his page and like saw different things. I was like, okay, I got to go back to what we were talking about. But I was just looking up things, clicking different links, and I was like, oh, that's interesting.
That's how this kind of started. I would make like the Today in History posts on Instagram, and then I just go down a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
I'd be like, you know, oh, there's a small incident that happened, and I'd look a little bit into it for some whatever, and it was like, that wasn't a small incident. Like, it was, like, there's such a story behind
exactly.
that. And then that goes into these other things, and it's like, you can't, I mean, Instagram, you can post as much as you want, but it's, you know, nobody's going to read more than a paragraph. So
yeah.
It's like, some of those stories would be cool to get out there.
Exactly. You just go on a rabbit hole, especially on Wikipedia. It's like, oh, what's that? You hover over it. It's like, cool. You click on it, another page. And you got a whole a lot more words to read up now.
We used to do that in tech school. We'd have somebody would have to pick two topics, completely unrelated topics. And one of them was what you started on, and the other is what you had to finish on. And you could only get there with hyperlinks.
Yep.
Everything's connected. You look deep enough.
Yep. So when Eddie Rickenbacker returned, all of his shoot downs in the war, he returned a war hero. People were flocking to him for promotional deals, trying to get him a job because he was the face of fame for the most part. So people were trying to get capitalize on that, from movie productions to advertisements. And he was approached to be able to go in to be a star in a film, but he turned down all those promotional. So his saying was he didn't want to cheapen his image, which I'm not really totally sure what that means. I guess I guess he doesn't want to be the one to be famous and then like go the typical famous route to get into movies and do different things. I think he wanted to do his own stuff, not the typical route that people usually take.
Right. And he was an interesting character. A lot of the things that he did didn't make a lot of sense necessarily. It was like he had a lot going on upstairs, and he had all these projects and stuff that he wanted to go towards, and he couldn't laser focus on any one of them. And I think there was a lot of fallout from that.
Yeah. So he was able to get some money. He actually signed a book deal for $25,000, which in inflation is $427,000 now.
So which is insane for a book deal.
Insane. Yeah. So he got almost $500,000 in today's money, $25,000 back then, for publishing his memoir of Fighting the Flying Circus, which is, you could buy it on Amazon and read it on your Kindle.
Yeah, it's still in print.
Yep. So I'm probably going to buy that and read it because I like reading stuff. But so yeah, that's where he got most of his money from when he came back from the war. And he also had a name. Rickenbacker was a staple name that he could probably capitalize on any business that he wanted to start.
Well, I guess that's about as good a place to stop as any. Make sure you come back next week for part two, when we talk about Eddie's life between the world wars and how he contributed to the war effort as a civilian in World War II. Be sure to check out Greg on YouTube and Instagram at Aviation Plus and Aviation Plus One, respectively. And of course, I'll link to those in the show notes. Don't forget to follow if you haven't. Stay safe, and as my wife always says, fluffy landings.